very grateful for your presence on this occasion tonight. Our crowd is a little slow gathering because the program was a little long over at Moody Coliseum, but we wanted to give everyone an opportunity to come who wanted to be here on this occasion and to get started. But we also want to give our speakers just as much time as they are signed to have so they can get their message in. But this is a hearty group. You are not worried about time. You're worried about gaining knowledge. Amen. And we're glad to have you here in this kind of in-depth study. Our first speaker tonight is Dr. Jack Lewis. Brother Lewis needs no introduction to any group, really, within our Churches of Christ, within our fellowship. And I don't care to give the introduction in the way of a formal thing that's written here, because Brother Lewis is much more personal to me. I had about 10 of my graduate classes at Harding Graduate School under him, so I know him pretty well from the classroom. I've had opportunity to tour the Holy Land with him and had him stay in our home while he conducted a gospel meeting where I was preaching, and we really love and appreciate Brother Lewis in a tremendous way and his scholarship, and we're happy to have him to present us his paper at this time.
I think Vermin got in most of the things that I told him to say in that introduction. In view of the fact that a great many times it has been alleged that our claim that use of italics in English Bible translation is a mark of special integrity on the part of translators, and then the converse of that has been alleged that the failure to use italics is a mark of lack of integrity on the part of translators, it seems to me that it is imperative that we evaluate this particular practice. The need for evaluation has become all the more urgent in view of the fact that italics are used in current translations for an entirely different purpose from that which they were used in the older translations. The practice of using italics or indicating words in translations that are not represented in the original languages is traced back to a translation of Sebastian Munster, who prepared a Latin Bible back in 1534. It was really a bilingual Bible with both Greek and Latin, but he indicated the items in the Latin Bible that were not represented in Greek by a different type, a sort of type. This particular translation gave the same impetus to Old Testament study that had been given by Erasmus when he prepared his New Testament, Greek New Testament, that it had given to New Testament study. And I've already committed one mistake by suggesting that Munster was working with Greek. He really was working with Hebrew and with Latin. Now also in that same year, which is 1535, Pierre Robert prepared a French Bible in which also the added words were indicated in a smaller font of type than was true of the regular translation. And it is from that source, then, that it passed on into to the Geneva Bible. Meanwhile, with the publication of the Great Bible, there was the practice, momentarily, of indicating what we would call textual variants in the Bible by using a different type from the ordinary type. There were 130 cases in the Great Bible of this sort, but they did vary from time to time with the various editions, as those editions then came out. Theodore Beza, in 1556, reverted to the practice of Munster of indicating the supplied words, that is, to distinguish them from the textual variants, by using a different type. And then William Whittingham, in his New Testament of 1557, which was printed in Roman type, chose to print the words that are not represented in the Greek text by italic type. It thereby passed on into the Geneva Bible, and Whittingham was one of the preparers of the Geneva Bible, and so it became the first completed English Bible to print Roman type and then to use italic type for those words that have been supplied by the translators. It did use italics also for marginal references and for the content summaries before the chapters. The Bishop's Bible in 1568, and then the second edition, or the third edition in 1572, followed this same practice of indicating the added words. However, since it was in black type, then the added words were in small Roman type, rather than in italics. The 1611 King James Bible was first printed in black type, and so the foreign words, like Talitha Kumi and others, were printed in smaller type, however, not with complete consistency. And then the supplied words were printed in smaller Roman type. The rules that are given by the translators laid out no basis for using different sorts of type in this basis, but the report given to the Synod of Dort on the 11th of November did say that different type had been used for those words it felt necessary to supply. Now, when it became customary then to print the King James in Roman type, it became customary to use italics for these added words, just as is the custom today. However, one should be aware of the fact that those words have not been a constant entity across the entire history of the King James Bible. Now, Scrivener, in his analysis of the 1611 King James Bible, has shown that italics were used for many more purposes than the ordinary person has been aware. And we won't go into the details of all of the six categories that Scrivener set forth, but point out that textual variants were included in this group. And then the largest number of them all would be those places where it's necessary to add words, because English requires words that really are not required by either Greek or by Hebrew. And this category is equal in number to all the others, but at the same time is probably the most doubtful of value of all the others. Now, as I've said, the number of words italicized has not been a fixed number since 1611, but rather has been fluid, varying from edition to edition across this entire period of time. The edition of 1638 had different italics from 1611, and though the edition of 1629 had had different italics from the 1611 and from the 1638. However, the 1638 became the standard Bible down until F.F. Paris in 1762 did an overhaul of the italic system. And then further modifications were made in 1769 with the work of Benjamin Blaney. And Blaney's work then remained the standard until Scrivener published the Cambridge Paragraph Bible in 1873. The Paragraph Bible is important because it does represent the most extensive use of italics of the printed English Bibles, the most extensive effort to try to be uniform in the printing of italics came at this time. Now, just to give a sample or two, a passage like Exodus 32, verse 18, has 13 Hebrew words translated into 36 English words. Five of these 36 were italicized in 1611, and these had become 11 in the Paragraph Bible of 1873, but then were reduced to 10 in the American Bible Society printings that are being circulated at the present time. The Gospel of Matthew had 57 marked words in 1611. These were expanded to 165 in 1623 and to 244 in 1638, and then these had become 583 by the Cambridge Paragraph Bible. The current American Bible Society printings have 363 in that situation. Now, it would be possible for us to take a great many other passages and to demonstrate this same thing. That is, that there have been repeated changes across the history of the printing of the King James Bible, coming to a high watermark in number in the Paragraph Bible, and then reduced in number from that time on down to our own time. The Gospel of John in chapter 11 had no marked words in 1611, but in 1638 it carried 15, and these had become 34 by 1873, and then reduced in the Bible Society printings now to 17 different words. Now, despite all the care that is expended by these various editors on the italic system, there still are great inconsistencies in the current printings of the King James Bible on this particular matter. Now take a statement like, you are to pass in Deuteronomy 2 and verse 3. The verb is italicized. But now another phrase of that same nature, thou art to pass, Deuteronomy 2:18, has no italics. And even unto us in Deuteronomy 2:18 has even italicized. But even to this day, Deuteronomy 2:20, which is exactly the same Hebrew phrase, has no italics. And you can repeat this same sort of thing in the New Testament almost an unlimited number of times. Now, this continuous process of change then justifies the conclusion stated by the 1885 Revision Committee after they had mentioned some of those who had introduced changes in the italics prior to that date, then said of the changes, none of them, however, rests on any higher authority than that of the persons who from time to time superintended the publication. Now, that raises, I think, a very important question for us. When the various printings using italics for supplied words use the same words, as is true in the translation, and some of these words are italicized and some of them are not, then what dependence can the English reader put on italics as an indication for what the original text had, and on the other hand, what is being supplied? Now, realizing the need to try to bring order into a very confused situation, the Revision Committee then, in Rule Number 7 of the General Principles for the Revision of 1881-85, provided for a revision of the italics. Now, in keeping with that policy, then the revisers of the American Standard Version made considerably less use of italics than did the King James translation, even in those places where it has exactly identical wording otherwise. Now, Psalm 84, none of the words overlapping the King James are italicized in the American Standard Version, though some were in the King James, and we're talking about exactly the same wording. But on the other hand, the American Standard's addition to Zion in verse number 5 is italicized. Now, it would be found, both in the King James and in the American Standard, numerous words that have been supplied that are not italicized at all. For example, the word may in Ruth 1:4, and ought in Ruth 1:17, and fast in Ruth 2 and verse 8. There would be cases where one wonders what's going on when both translations take a phrase like arson, and this is translated then man-child, combined word in Romans 12, verse 5, but then also is translated as man, child, underscored child, in Revelation 2 and verse 13. Both the same Greek phrase in the two cases. Pneumatikos is spiritual gift in Romans 1:11 with no italics, but on the other hand, in 1 Corinthians 12 and verse 1 is spiritual gift with gift italicized. I think that this raises a rather important question for us. Now, again, a very long length of cases of this type can be supplied. And sometimes the American Standard, by use of italics, continued an interpretation which had been given by the King James, but which interpretation really represents an unfair treatment of the passage that is being considered. Both the King James and the American Standard were reluctant to have Stephen to pray to Jesus. And so the King James has it, him calling on God, italicized God, and saying, Lord Jesus. The American Standard has calling upon the Lord, and the Lord italicized, and saying. But the Revised Standard and the NIV correctly drop the added words in this case and read, as Greek in this should be, he prayed, Lord Jesus, receive my spirit. Now, another case of this sort would be the addition of the word our in the phrase, the finisher of our faith, in Hebrews 12 and verse 2. This addition goes back to William Tyndale, and without the addition, it's Jesus' own faith that is perfected, and of course, with the addition, it is the believer's faith that is being spoken of in this particular case. Now, these are samplings that we've had a look at, and they can be multiplied at great length. The outcome of this particular problem is that 20th century translations have, to a major extent, abandoned any effort to identify added words by italics. This began at least with the Revised Standard Version, maybe earlier than that, though I didn't analyze early ones of the 20th century. And we now have page headings italicized, maybe chapter headings italicized. But with the exception of the New American Standard Bible and the Scofield Bible, the latter of which is really a King James with merely some words changed, 20th century translations do not indicate supplied words by italics. Now, the RSV did use footnotes in italics, and they also give other information about what they've done in the marginal notes. The New English Bible uses italics for page headings and also for some elements in the marginal notes, and then use italics for such foreign words as Maranatha, although you may find some places where it's not entirely consistent in this case, but no effort to try to indicate what the supplementary words are. The New Scofield Bible italicizes the words that it has in common with the italicized words of the King James Bible. You can compare those with the current Bible Society printings. They're harmonious with those printings. But then they carry in brackets a number of center reference notes where they've modified the wording of the King James. Now, as I've said already, the only translation made in the second half of the 20th century to try to indicate added words in italics would be the New American Standard Version. The New American Standard inserts words in at least 2,029 different instances in the New Testament. Some of these are in common with the American Standard and had already been italicized there. But you'll notice that there is a preference in New American Standard for inserting the word some in its phrases. So we have some tax gatherers and some soldiers and some Pharisees and some grain fields and some bread, and again, a great multitude of cases. The use of italics allowed the New American Standard translators to encroach upon the domain of the commentator in their supplements to the text. Quite often an idea is sharpened or is restricted by the added word, when in reality no added word was necessary. But we have "you alone." Now, I don't know any way to do this except just to emphasize the word, which is what they didn't intend for you to do in reading it. And the emphasized word is not what the passage should emphasize, but it is the word that's italicized. And when I stop doing that, I'll tell you that I stopped doing that. So we have "single cubit," and in Matthew 6:27, and "that very hour" in Matthew 8:13, and the plant takes firm root, Matthew 13:21, and the Son of Man is right at the door, Matthew 24. Well, here again, this is a very large category that could take up a great deal of our time. But you'll do a check on these, you do find that it does sharpen or restrict the idea in a great many cases. Now, the insertion of the word "including" in Acts chapter 6, verse 9, eliminates the exegetical possibility that libertinon, freedmen, could be a geographical term along with the other geographical terms of the verse. Now, I'm not saying that I think it is, but it locks and bars the door against that translation. Now and then, side comments have been thrown in italics. So Jesus heals the man, Matthew 7:33, with the saliva that he's spit on the ground. And then we have in Luke 5:39, "the old is good enough." Now, I'd like to submit that "the old is good" has an entirely different implication from the implication that "the old is good enough." And you correctly say that I am a king in John 18:37. And again, in the 2,029 cases, many more examples of this sort could be brought to our attention. In many cases, the possessive pronoun has been supplied in italics for where the Greek language had just the definite article. So we have "his child" and "their journey" and "his name" and "his resurrection" in quite a series of passages. In those cases where it takes two English words to translate one Greek or Hebrew word, the New American italicizes one of those words. So we have "fiery serpents" in Numbers 21:8. Or we have the cornerstone in Psalm 18:22 and its parallel passages. Now, in each of these cases, the second word is italicized, but the italics is completely superfluous. The word serpent in the first of these phrases is just as justified as the word fiery. And the word stone is just as justified as is the word corner. And for that matter, in Judges 38:6 and Isaiah 28:16, we have cornerstone as one continued word with nothing italicized in that particular case. Now, another example of this sort of thing is the Hebrew sentence, which is called a nominal sentence that doesn't require, in Hebrew, a verb. But in English, to translate the verb, you have to supply some form of the verb to be. And I would argue that to be, whatever form you supply, is not superfluous. In this case, you couldn't have an English sentence without it. So the Canaanite was then in the land, Genesis 12, verse 6. But on the other hand, just exactly the same sort of structure, in Amos 7, verse 14, I'm not a prophet, has no italics at all. Now, though the italics are abundantly used in the New American Standard, they cannot invariably be depended on to tell you where a word has been added by the translators that's not represented in the original. Now, if the translators gave a literal rendering in the margin, then they felt no need to give italics in the text, never mind what it was that they had added. And again, a rather large group of these can be collected, like his own sons, the word own, in Deuteronomy 33 and verse 9. The word false is not italicized in the word false circumcision, Philippians 3:2, but the word true in the next phrase is italicized in true circumcision. Now, both of these are just one phrase, and you probably need italics in both ways, both places, if you're going to try to italicize anything in this particular case. Take a phrase like the spiritual service of worship of Romans 12:1. Well, here we have no words italicized, though it represents only two Greek words. Now, we'll move from that translation. The Living Bible paraphrased has little in common in its usage of italics with these translations that we've been talking about before. A paraphrase is not a translation, and it doesn't lend itself to indicating what you've added in this sort of way. Taylor did use square brackets to enclose the more obvious glosses that he had made on the text, oftentimes with a note claiming that the information of the gloss is supplied. In my evaluation, when you come across the word implied in Taylor's paraphrase, this means be on guard, something that's not in the text has been supplied. Now, Taylor does use italics for speaker identifications. He uses italics for instructions to the speakers. And then there are some places that I couldn't figure out why they were italicized at all. And that's 1 Kings 8, 10 to 11, Matthew 8, 2 to 4, entire verses. Now, in keeping with current usage, Taylor did italicize the words that he wanted to emphasize. And so the tree is in the center of the garden, Genesis 3, verse 3. And we have living water in John 4 and verse 10. And the Lord will give you the land, Leviticus 25 and verse 37. Now, these cases are not like the freshman's composition where he underscores every other word and thereby completely eliminates all the emphasis that is intended. But in reality, the items that are emphasized in this way are a better test of Taylor's theology or his religious orientation than they would be of anything else at all. And not to be confused in any way with the supplying of added terms. Now, the Good News Bible has italics very sparingly. And it has foreign words that are italicized. It has page headings, section headings italicized. But again, you see very little in common with the older practice. The same is also true of the New American Standard Bible. The New American Standard did not attempt to indicate italicized words. It did indicate in half brackets the more obvious glosses. There are words that had been supplied for which there is no specific or explicit word that lies back of it. These half brackets, however, are not parallel, are not an effort to be equal to the older practice of italicizing words, and they shouldn't lead a person to a false confidence, because you can easily build up a very long group of added words that are not italicized at all. Now, this great variety, then, seems to me to say something that we need to listen to. Rather than being the honesty of word translation, quote unquote, for that phrase, italics really have proved to be a very mixed blessing to the reader. And certain cautions are definitely in order. Italics are not an infallible guide to what the reader has supplied in making the translation. In a great many cases, the italics are actually superfluous, and the word doesn't need to be italicized at all. Now, the nominal Greek sentence, which uses the verb to be, that I illustrated a few moments ago, would be an example of that sort of thing. And sentences of this sort began in Genesis number 1 and run on through to the very end of Scripture. No translating group has ever been consistent in italicizing all the words that have been supplied. Again, you can find cases in which the italics are definitely in error. Mark chapter 13, 34 would be one example of that sort in the King James Bible. There would be also places in which people have been entrapped. They yielded to the temptation of putting the type of emphasis that my reading was doing a while ago on the italicized word, and you get a wrong emphasis. After all, that is the way that we know italics best in current-day English. So in 1 Kings 13, 27, he said to his servant, "Sir, saddle me the ass," and he saddled him, is one of those cases. In Psalm 19, verse 3, the word "where their voice is not heard" changes the meaning of that particular psalm. The passage actually says, "their voice is not heard." In John 3, 34, the phrase "unto him" unduly limits the statement that's being made in that case. And I think the most obvious example known to all of us is "unknown tongue" in 1 Corinthians, which is surely responsible for some of the problems that we've had with the glossolalia movement. It may not be known to you that in that same chapter, that in verse 5, 6, 18, 22, 23, 26, and 39, that same word occurs without italics being used. Now, italics have sometimes been used to turn the reader from an interpretation that the translator didn't want him to use. And here again, there are certain traps that are involved. Now, Judges, Job 19, 25 to 26, the italicized words, makes that passage to be a resurrection passage, which it might not be without the italicized words. In 1 Corinthians 7, 36, 37, in either the King James or the American Standard, the italicized words give a particular interpretation that the passage otherwise might not have. And again, this is a rather lengthy list. A great deal of judgment enters into this question of what words to italicize. And I think I pointed out already that you have exactly the same wording in the King James in certain passages that the American Standard then continued, and the King James italicized certain words, and the American Standard didn't italicize those words. Now, one example is 1 Corinthians 15, 41. The King James italicizes "there is," and "one," and "another." In that passage, the American Standard doesn't italicize anything. And so I'd like to point out then that the use of italics in translation developed quite late in the translation of Scripture, and it really hasn't proved to be a safeguard against falling into danger. In a high percentage of cases, the italics is superfluous and thereby becomes worthless to direct the reader in what has been added, and on the other hand, what hasn't been added. And there is this continuous temptation to fall into the practice of emphasizing what the translator didn't intend to be emphasized and what the original writer didn't have in the text at all. One of my colleagues came back from a seminar he had been to in South America and talked about a religious group whose entire theology was based on italicized words in the King James Bible. Now, it might be wholesome to end this up to remind anybody that would like to exalt the use of italics in translations into a saving virtue, that when the Greek scriptures are cited in the New Testament, they are considered to be authoritative, but they're unencumbered by devices that call attention to their deviation from the way in which these translations differ from the original Hebrew scriptures.
Thank you very much, Brother Lewis. And I'm always amazed at the patience that Brother Lewis has to dig out a lot of these intricate things that are, in so many ways, vital, misleading, as these have been on so many occasions. And we appreciate his diligence and care and concern to try to call our attention to these. I should mention that Brother Lewis has a book that is soon to be published by Baker Bookhouse on the history and evaluation of English translations, and we are very appreciative for his work for that, and I know you'll want to get a copy of that, and he may care to say something more about the book and acquaint you with more of its nature when he comes back to answer your questions. Do we have those who have the... You got the mics ready? All right. Let's have a few questions, if you have. Anybody have some questions that you'd like to ask of Dr. Lewis? All right, Terry?
Brother Lewis, is that on? Two questions. One is this information available in manuscript form and print form somewhere, or is it going to be in your book? And the second question is I've heard the objection raised specifically by Dr. Hugo McCord that italics seem to give emphasis. Is there something else that you might suggest, such as the half brackets or something, that would make you, for something sort of readable and yet sort of provide the same information in the translation?
This material will, I hope, someday be published, but it's not a part of my book. There would be some treatment, shorter treatment, of some of these questions within the book. This is supposed to be a chapter in a book that I don't know whether they're going to ever get it published or not. Now, to the second one of the questions, it seems to me that the effort to indicate by italics is wrong-headed to begin with. It is based upon the idea that you really can translate one word for one word in translation, and this is not correct. You can't do it from any language, whether it's a modern language into another modern language or an ancient language into a modern language. And I think that our best safeguard is just to translate as accurately as we can, and not do as I think the New American Standard did, feel if you italicize it, you can put most anything in.
Okay, do we have another question? Yes.
Is there any translation that you recommend over others, and why?
I don't think that there's any translation that a person can take and without studying carefully to see what's being said in this case. And I think that a great many of the translations that you now have are quite suitable for serious study. It depends on what, you know, it's just sort of like, is there any automobile that you would recommend? Well, it depends on what you want the automobile. If you want to carry 10 people, well, a Volkswagen won't do that. If, on the other hand, you want to get 40 miles to the hour, the Cadillac's not going to do that. So there may be a place for translations, for simple translations, for people that need that. And on the other hand, for the more detailed translations, for people that that need those. So we have quite a variety, and I think a person can find out how to go to heaven out of all of them if he'll do adequate study of it.
One conclusion I came to after hearing all those numbers of italics is a fellow could learn Greek quicker than he can figure out italics.
Dr. Lewis, if the whole idea of italics is wrong, that is, it's not a word in English to parallel a particular word in Greek or Hebrew, and the whole concept being that the idea is to be translated and therefore justified in whatever phraseology that the English might have appropriate for that. Doesn't that give more credence, so to speak, to something like Taylor's version of the Living Bible, whereby he is fairly free in terms of English, but his attempt is really to give the essence or the meaning of the original, regardless of how many words are used, recognizing he may have gone on theologically, and because it may have the danger of one man's theology getting frozen in there, but isn't there some justification for that kind of free use of ideas rather than a word for word?
Well, the thrust that I was trying to make with the paper is that that we have been tempted to put an undue dependence upon a system that really is unworkable and which is misleading in the way that it has been applied. Now, if you can move from 200 italics to 585 and then move back to 300 whatever it was, how can you depend on it?
In the early part of your paper, you talk about textual variants being indicated in Geneva Bible and other early versions. Your use of textual variants there, does it have to do with manuscript variants, or is this were they familiar with different manuscript
variants? I suppose that people have always, his question is, when I talked about italics for textual variants, did I mean manuscript variants? And the answer is, I did. The King James Bible does cite textual variants in the 1611 edition in certain passages. It's no longer the custom to print these variants, but they were there to begin with. And now, I didn't say the King James, well, it did. King James also did use some italics for some textual variants.
Any other questions, Steve?
Dr. Lewis, do you believe that the inconsistency that many of these translations that are using italics have had could be due to the fact that some of the translators were more scrupulous in the use of italics than others, and so they were responsible for certain sections, and there wasn't an overall editing that made use of the italics?
I think we don't have the information to answer the question that you raised, really. And I've not done an analysis that would indicate that that there's any great difference in sections on this particular question.
Any other questions? Bruce has another one, I believe.
Yes, Dr. Lewis, I believe that you noted that, was it Scrivener, that noted six different uses of italics in the King James Bible, and you mentioned the supplied words and the textual variants. Could you briefly tell us the other four, if you remember what they are?
Well, I was afraid that we'd have this this particular problem, and I do have the list of the entire group of them here, if we can turn back far enough and find that that part of the paper. Number one, when words quite are nearly to complete the sense of the sacred writers have been introduced into the text from parallel passages of Scripture. And as you have a sentence that doesn't seem to be complete, so you reach over someplace else and get supplementary information to complete this sentence, and so that those supplementary sections would be italicized. And Scrivener said that's where the text seems to have lost necessary words. Number two, when the compactness of the Hebrew language intelligible enough to those that are well versed in it, yet is hardly capable of being transferred into a modern language. Number three, when an expression which strictly belongs to one member of a sentence, with some violation of strict propriety, is made to do duty in another. And as you see, if the Hebrew language had the verb way down at the end and you put it up the first, well, then you would italicize that that word. When inserting a word or two in order to indicate the abrupt transition from oblique to direct form of speech, which is so familiar to most ancient languages but so foreign to our own, and to indicate that a word or clause is of doubtful authority as a matter of textual criticism. That's your textual variant you were asking about a while ago. Number six, then, the case where words are supplied are essential to the English sense, although they have been they could be very well dispensed with in Hebrew or in Greek. Now, Scrivener says this last category has more cases than all the others. I am dealing with his book on the authorized version of the Bible, And you will find these six cases there together with supporting examples for all six of them.
Okay, I believe that's about the time we have for the questions tonight. And we appreciate so very much, Brother Lewis, your outstanding work and patience and scholarship and coming and sharing with us. And I certainly appreciate so very much Brother Lewis personally and the many things that he has done to teach me and to help me. He arranged for me to go to Hebrew Union, arranged for me to have a place to preach and living and all while I was there. So I'm very grateful for him and all he's meant to me.